Hey, would you like us to read a story of your choosing? Well, you're in luck. Head on over to superhumanregistrationpodcast.com and fill out the web form at the Contact Us link. If you submit a story there that is available to read on Marvel Unlimited, we will consider it for a future episode of the show. The world's not as simple as it used to be. It's not enough to be a good guy anymore. We have to be the best. The time has come. All will be accounted for. Or we will hunt them. Stand up. It's time to be the heroes we were always meant to be.
Yes.
Yes.
My name is Geoff.
I wasn't here, baby doll. I punched one thing with G's, and it's not Jerry's, it's Jeff's.
What was that?
You better calm down, kitty cat.
It's called a callback, see?
We've been talking for like a half hour, but we've been recording for like 30 seconds. Nobody's going to know what we're talking about.
Don't matter, see? This goes on the cutting room floor. This is the outtakes,
this one's
baby.
For me, baby doll.
That's how we do it in the business. I do one for you and I do one for me.
Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, brothers and sisters, and aficionados of all things comics, welcome to the Superhuman Registration Podcast, a show where we read and rank and review the stories of Marvel Unlimited. My name is Steven. I have John and Aldo on the line with me. Guys, how are you doing this evening?
Fantastic.
Good.
I'm glad people are doing good. I don't know about you guys. This has been, like, just the weirdest day. I'm glad we're almost done with it.
Mm-hmm. You know it.
I expect time moves differently for you this month than in previous months in your
whole
life.
Yeah, so you know what I learned? That if you're engaged for 5 months, the fifth month is actually, like, 5 months in and of itself. And
yeah.
All of those months are dumb.
Yeah. Yeah, mm-hmm. I was engaged for 9 months. That's on my list of dumbest things I've ever done, was a 9-month engagement.
You could have made a baby in that time.
I don't have a good follow-up. Let's just go.
Nothing. He's got nothing. All right, so I'm excited. We got a couple of different comics on the agenda for today. We are playing a little bit of catch-up. We had planned on reading some Black Panther for Black History Month, but... It's now March.
I don't think that we should limit celebrating... there's no way to say this without being weird. Black History Month shouldn't just be... Black History shouldn't be just in 1 month. Yeah.
Why can't every month be Black History Month?
I mean, that's also like saying, you know, why should you only wait till Valentine's? It's a cheap cop-out. You celebrate extra hard.
Yeah.
That's why.
I'm a product of the liberal education system, and I came away from college pretty much convinced that the history of the United States is basically the history of the United States being crappy to brown people.
It's a story.
You're not wrong.
Yeah. Admittedly, I might be biased by the fact that I took a bunch of classes on both the Civil War and African American literature, and when I moved my gaze to outside of the United States, I focused on South African literature, which is also quite racially loaded. Racially charged is the term.
Jeez, Aldo. Steven's being real down on white people.
I know.
Right now.
This is why you can't have nice things.
Strangely topical comment, John. We'll get to that.
I have opinions.
Funny thing is, I'm not actually talking about Black Panther with that.
Oh.
But why don't we go ahead and start with the Black Panther book, since that's where we're talking right now.
We read Black Panther from 1998, written by Christopher Priest. Vince Evans was the penciler, or at least in issue 5. Sorry, I'm trying to bring the whole series up in front of me. But basically, the story is that Black Panther came to the U.S. He came to right a wrong that had been done in the name of a foundation that Wakanda is involved in. A child died. A horrible tragedy.
We get told that multiple times.
Uh-huh. He ends up thwarting the devil and losing control of Wakanda, though he doesn't know it yet. Dun, dun, dun! That's the real short version, because I wanted to make sure we had enough time to actually talk about the thing. But basically, everything is told from the point of view of Agent Ross, who was played by Martin Freeman in Black Panther. There were a lot of similarities, I think, between this particular story we read and things that we see in the Black Panther movie. One of them is the character of Agent Ross. He's kind of supposed to be like the government, kind of like a, you know, he's like the contact, the handler for Black Panther as a foreign dignitary, and manages just to screw things up and is basically an observer as Black Panther does his business and kicks all the butts there are to kick, and up to and including the devil, who is involved with the bad guy in the story, who's stirring up trouble back in Wakanda. And Agent Ross loses his pants, and that's a big part of the whole thing. He loses his pants.
After they go to the Chinese restaurant.
But after the Chinese restaurant. So, I mean, sometimes I worry that I think I liked something until you guys say, no, it was crappy. And I worry. But I think that I had problems with this. Maybe it's just that it hasn't, like, aged well, and that other things have come out that try telling a story in this way or whatever. But there are things about this that I liked. And overall, I'd say that I liked it. And now you guys can tell me if I'm right or not.
So I liked it. I'm actually very much in the same boat as you, where I have some issues with it. Primarily, I think, with the art.
Yeah, the art was just not good.
I don't know that I even agree with that necessarily. I think it's interesting, and it occasionally dabbles in badness. Mm. But when it's good, I think it's very good.
There's a handful of shots that work for me. Kind of towards the end with Mephisto, that's okay.
Yeah, the devil is in this book. Not in the details, but like in all of it. And that's pretty great. There are just like some particular things that really kind of bugged me as far as the art. There are a couple of panels where you see like Ross, his proportions are super weird. Like he's got...
His really face changed hands. Like every page. Yeah. You know, it was ridiculous. Like, I don't know who they were, like, modeling him after, but it was just weird all the time. And the whole, like, the way that it was framed, like, that was kind of interesting, but, like, I don't know. I didn't like that, like, it was a debriefing, but then it turned out that he was dating his superior or whatever and wanted to have naked banjo time. And then it was back to, like, where it was like, if this was really a briefing, you wouldn't, like, continue the conversation from coffee to the car to the bedroom to the more breakfast the next morning. And it's like, just sum up what happened, man. There's, like, lives at risk, you know? Like, get the thing over with. But anyway.
Yeah. There's a part of me that actually kind of liked that framing device, honestly.
You're a fan of Naked Banjo, I forgot. That's right. You have all those albums and cassettes.
Ooh. I'm more a fan of non-linear storytelling.
Yeah, that's fine. I felt like we were kind of rehashing things several times, but it is kind of like we have to catch everybody up on each issue, you know. And maybe it's just because, like, this is almost 20 years old now, and we've seen, you know, non-linear narrative or whatever, and things told like this. Like, after the fact, for effect, you know. I don't know. I'd say, like, overall, it was still good. I still enjoyed it. I want to read more about the Black Panther.
Definitely, definitely. Now, am I mistaken, or is the credited storyteller on these first couple of issues Joe Quesada?
That's what I didn't understand. He's in there as a storyteller, but the writer, it says, like, Black Panther by Christopher Priest, so I'm confused. What do you guys know about that?
Almost nothing. Like, when I read, like, I'm actually looking online at an interview that Christopher Priest did with Vulture magazine, and Priest said that one of his requirements, if he was going to come onto Marvel and do the Black Book, he didn't want to, because it's too easy to pigeonhole Black characters. But he said, like, if I'm going to do this, I want to do it my way, and that means have a white protagonist, so this isn't just the Black Book, which is why...
That feels, like, counterintuitive to how things would be done today. Or maybe that it's... They were trying to make it more approachable then, and now it feels like, why do we have to have a white character explaining all of this, you know?
Yeah, it is interesting. I think what that does is it helps to cement Black Panther in a world that the predominantly, presumably predominantly white reading audience could relate to, because it sets it in the United States rather than Africa, which frankly, like, we don't really know that much about African history in the United States in general, and so some of the cultural aspects of it might be difficult for, again, the presumed white male audience to grasp.
Yeah.
And so I kind of get where Priest was coming from on this, especially, like, thinking back to the way the comics were in the, you know, 90s, you're dealing with, I don't know, like, the black characters weren't front and center at Marvel. They hadn't really had much of a, like, the renaissance. I don't even know if renaissance is the right word. But, like, you had Bendis come in and rehabilitate Luke Cage. And then getting into the later 2000s, you have greater diversity among not just the writing staff, but also the editorial at Marvel. And so they're really pushing for these different viewpoints. So I don't really understand the rationale behind it. It kind of makes sense to me, but it is weird.
I think, yeah, in its time, maybe it could be understood as, like, yeah, here's a nice introduction to Black Panther that won't scare you away because, you know, you're not looking for these type of stories like we are now. Like, now it's like, give me something with a, you know, a character that's not just a you know, better version of me. You know, like, I want to see someone different.
I'm just hung up on how white this book reads.
Okay,
there we go.
I kind of want to hear you expound on that a little bit.
So there's a lot of the dialogue. So here's the thing. So Tarantino is a really good writer when it comes to writing black dialogue, which is kind of a heavy loaded subject. But, like, long story short, you know, he kind of grew up in those sorts of neighborhoods surrounded by that sort of language, meaning that when he writes it, it's authentic, kind of similarly to how, you know, how Spike Lee would write black dialogue. It's something they grew up around. This, a lot of the dialogue in here, especially, like, some of the gangster stuff, stuff with the Black Panther when he's in the States, it really comes across as, like, really try hard cool black language. And the only person or only character who any of this works for is Ross, who to me comes across as, like, the very try hard I'm trying to be cool white guy of the 90s. Like, I saw...
Absolutely.
I saw 8 Mile. I know what's up. I've listened to Tupac once. and I think
he came out in 2002, I think. But Tupac, yeah, he died in the 90s. So that works. Jeez,
okay. anyways, so, like, it works for Everett. I mean, even his introduction in issue 1, it says... let me find it. It says, Everett... Everett K. Ross, Midnight Warrior, Everett K. Ross, Superfly.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Yeah. And I think, and I don't know if this is on purpose, or if it's accidental, or maybe it's just the stars aligned in 1990-something, but T'Challa looks a lot like Snoop Dogg.
Oh, my gosh.
Especially especially on page 6 of the first issue. He looks like Snoop Dogg in that.
I guess. I mean, I don't think anybody looks like Snoop Dogg if they don't have the hair. And T'Challa is very bald.
Yeah, but not in that picture because there's the shadows. It blends.
Yeah, you can't tell. No, definitely see in the face he kind of does look like Snoop Dogg. And it's really funny because, like, you know, Snoop Dogg has the goatee.
Uh-huh.
Does T'Challa actually have a goatee? I think that's just a mustache.
In this series, no, I goatee. Think he has a goatee.
Yeah. And it's really hard for me to tell because of all the shadows. And then, like, for the rest of the issue, he has his mask on.
Yeah.
I do not like this art. It's... and Black Panther with a cape.
Yeah.
He's got a Dracula cape.
And so I don't mind the cape at all.
Part of, like, the disingenuity to me about this kind of being... And, like, reading so white is... He's African royalty, but he kind of dresses like a high-class rapper. And there's something a little off about that. There's nothing about him says African king, except the dialogue constantly trying to remind us that he's an African king. But visually, yeah, there's a disconnect. He doesn't look like that. The Dora Milaje, is that how they're pronounced?
I've always pronounced it Dora Milaje, which I think is how they pronounce it in the movie, but I'm not positive.
They don't look like warrior women. And they keep constantly...
They look like something else.
Yeah, we keep constantly getting told that they're very beautiful. They look like they're the leading ladies in a rap video. And that they're very young. Did I mention that one already? And I don't know. They don't really... They portray a different message than like what we're being told they are. Which is really juxtaposed by Zuri, who just looks like a big African, like, savage brute man. And that's a little uncomfortable, who is also a drunk, I guess. Maybe I think my biggest issue with this is the mistake that I've already watched the 2018 fantastic Black Panther film, like, 17 times.
Academy Award winning for production design and something else, I think.
And nominated for Best Picture.
Nominated for Best Picture, yeah.
Yeah. So a lot of the stuff kind of feels off. And it's very 90s. Like, I think this is kind of par for the course of the 90s. And I think it's funny because it kind of wears that on its sleeve. Because there's a couple references here to, like, Quentin Tarantino films. Everett kind of gets called out for trying to tell the story in the style of Pulp Fiction. But that kind of cements it to me in the fact that this is somebody really trying to do Pulp Fiction and not understanding why Pulp Fiction was as good as it was.
Yeah. Interesting. Since you brought up the movie, I am going to point out that the comic here does one thing that the movie absolutely does not. And I'm going to say that this is something that the comic technically has over the movie. Issue 4, page 12. The movie does not have Everett Ross trying to take off the pants that he got from the devil and not being able to, so he is standing in a pile of discarded pants that are devil pants that he cannot take off.
Yeah,
that bit is amazing, and I love it.
Yeah.
I also, like, I love the confrontation between T'Challa and Mephisto here towards the end. Yeah,
I was like, how's he going to get out of this one? So that was, you know, the comic did its job.
Yeah, this is one of the, I think, advantages to having a point of view character who is not the superhero, because it kind of gives us this perspective of, like, we don't see the inner doubt, the inner turmoil, which is compelling in its own right. We rather see the point of view character doing the same thing that we're doing. Oh no, how is the hero going to get out of this one? And then we just get to be impressed by what the hero does. Like, in this story, T'Challa never feels like he's at a disadvantage when he is fighting the literal devil. I don't know if I can say literal devil, because Mephisto isn't the literal devil. He is a manifestation of something that could be construed as being the devil, you know, because comic book multiversity, timey-wiminess. But as a result, like, this is almost like reading a Superman story where Superman's going to solve the problem. We know Superman's going to solve the problem. What's exciting is to see how he does it. And in terms of just, like, powers, in terms of raw strength, at least within the confines of the fictional universe, Black Panther is not on the same level as Superman. Except in this story, he kind of is, because he outwits the devil. He gives the devil more pure souls than the devil can process and says, you can't leave until you eat them all. And it wears him out. I always like that solution where the bad guy's like, give me what I want. And the good guy says, okay, you want it, you get it. And then gives him more than he can handle. I mean, it's a pretty common trope. I always like it. It makes me happy.
So what you're saying is you really enjoyed the Ang Lee Hulk movie.
Which I've never seen. But I actually suspect I would like it. I honestly do.
I tried to watch it.
I enjoyed it.
I don't know. I'll give it a try one day.
He breaks a dog's jaw by, like, expanding his bicep. I love it.
Ugh, jeez.
So, although it brought up the point that the dialogue, everything feels what Christopher Priest is African American. He's from Queens.
No, what is he?
Yes, no. He is.
Yeah, yeah.
When I looked up Christopher Priest, he was white. British novelist. Oh,
Yep. The British wrong novelist, dude. Christopher Priest. That's the one who wrote The Prestige.
That's the one who wrote The Prestige. Remember, we had this.
He's not Christopher the comic Lloyd book writer.
Yeah,
we went over this.
Boy.
Yeah, no. Christopher Priest was born James Christopher Owlsley. He's from Queens. He legally changed his name to Christopher Priest circa 1993. He is one of the founders of Milestone Media, which was a comic imprint, I believe, through DC Comics. That's where Static Shock was first published. Dwayne McDuffie did a lot of work with them. I think he was a co-founder as well. I might be wrong on that.
First black editor and writer in comics.
Okay, I'm gonna retract my previous statement about this book feeling super white. But I'm just gonna alter that saying it feels super try hard. It still does.
The thing is, although you were saying all that, and I don't think I disagree with you. And I think it's important here that we place the caveat that none of us are black.
I'm the closest that we get. So... But really I'm just caramel. I'm still sweet, ladies.
Jeez.
Nobody likes vanilla. Maybe what we're seeing is an attempt to write to white mainstream comic book readers at the time, you know. Mm-hmm. And looking at it that way, I think it works, to try to introduce this character that you may not be familiar with in such a way that you wouldn't feel like, oh, that's like you said, as Stephen was saying earlier, it's, not just the black character or whatever.
There's a part of me that thinks that what we're reading and this dialogue is not necessarily what was actually said, but what was being filtered through Ross. And Ross, as we already know, is an Offspring song. He is pretty fly for a white guy.
But is he pretty fly?
I guess he's pretty fly, but not, that fly, like that.
Yeah.
I guess he's pretty fly for a white guy. I guess you're right.
I don't think Ross comes out of this looking terribly, impressive.
No.
He seems to misread all sorts of cues. He spends most of the book without pants on. I think Ross is kind of a ridiculous character. And it's something that I actually hope the movie leans into a little bit more. Because I think Martin Freeman could play that role very, very well.
I think he has played that role. And that was his Bilbo for a lot of it. That was definitely his Arthur Dent, in Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. He's done that already.
But I think with Everett Ross, there's an additional level of overconfidence, at least in this book. And so that's a sort of flavor that we haven't seen Freeman do in those other roles. It's a similar character, I'll give you that. But the Everett Ross of the movie is more competent.
But out of his league in Wakanda and out of his league around real superheroes, I think.
I mean, he's out of his league, but he still pulls his own weight. He pilots that ship at the end of Black Panther.
I would say that the Everett Ross that we see in the movies actually does feel like a grown-up version of the Ross we see in this comic.
I would buy that. Yeah. I would actually buy that. You tack another 20, 30 years on this Ross and that's it.
I say we time travel and kidnap a young Jamie Kennedy and have him play this version of Everett Ross.
Jamie Kennedy?
Isn't that just... Wait a minute, did we just create Malibu's Most Wanted just now?
Yeah.
Oh, there's one other thing that I want to point out, a little touch from this story that I also think is pretty great. And that is, what's the name of, we've talked about him a little bit already, the sort of retainer that comes with...
Zuri?
T'Challa. What was that?
Zuri?
Yeah, Zuri. Isn't that Forrest Whitaker's character from the movie?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah.
So Zuri is not Forrest Whitaker in this, very clearly. But what he does eat the devil's heart out of a pickle jar.
Yeah, takes a big old bite of it.
Kind of amazing.
Yeah.
But
you don't get that in every comic, so that's special.
You don't.
Yeah.
I think this comic is a really interesting experiment. It's definitely, like, inspiring in a way that I haven't seen the Black Panther written like this. As I've said before, I haven't read a whole lot of Black Panther. What I have read of him is the Black Panther, the super scientist, which you get in stories like I almost said Final Crisis, Secret Wars, or the political thriller Black Panther that we get in the Ta-Nehisi Coates stories. So Black Panther, just as a straight-up superhero who gets in a fist fight with the devil, I've not seen that before. I kind of like it.
Yeah.
But I kind of like it in a way where I don't disagree with any of the criticisms that have come up. I'm not 100% positive that this dialogue works, even though I think there's a way to kind of justify the clunkiness of it. I do struggle a lot with this art. And this story, as much as I love the nonlinear story, it is hard to follow. And it's hard to follow in a way that I don't think it serves it terribly well.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I think, yeah, there's seeds of good things here. And I say overall, it's still good. And makes me want to read more Black Panther. And so I think it does its job that way. But, yeah, maybe it's just we're looking at this from now and in the time it would have been different. But, yeah.
And, I mean, again, we have to add that caveat that this is not our experience. We are not Black, we are not right. African.
Right.
And I don't actually know as much of the background of this as, I don't know what drove Christopher Priest, what his motivations were behind this. There are elements of this that I really, really like and that I really respect. One of the foremost being that this is a story where the superhero prioritizes seeing justice for the little person done. He prioritizes bringing the murderer of this little girl to justice. And that's great. I always love it when superheroes do that sort of thing.
Yep.
But.
Yeah.
And that's all I got. It's like, I like all of this stuff, but I'm not sure how well it holds up today. Not that this isn't the building block for something greater. Not that there isn't something here that maybe I'm just missing.
It's tough when it's not your experience and I don't know. It's tricky.
It's hard to rock a rhyme.
And there's nothing wrong with reading something that's not your experience and it's not for you.
Sorry. I was about to respond to Steven and then Aldo got me with an old reference and now I'm just gone. I'm worthless. I'm just, you know. I like reading things that are, from a different viewpoint, but I can't speak to its, authenticity, how it feels, if it does its job as far as, like, you know, being culturally aware, being culturally sensitive. I don't know. It feels to me like something is off, and I can't tell if it's the 20 years that have, separated us from this book or something else, but here we are.
Yeah. Also, I'm super uncomfortable with the Dora Milaje.
Yeah, that's just kind of icky, isn't it?
Like, I loved their portrayal in the movie.
I think my problem with it is how focused it felt on the fact that they're underage, that they're beautiful, and that they're ripe to bees. Because they have their power moments. This kind of goes back to what I was saying, is like, we keep getting told that they're one thing, but the way they're portrayed is totally different. And we get a couple moments where they kick ass, and they're following orders, and they're kind of doing the thing. They're doing the really cool or badass women, or kick a butt. We don't take shit, except from the king. Sorry, I swore a little.
Yeah.
but like, every issue, it felt like we keep getting told, they're young, they're very beautiful, and he's gonna marry them. Like, and it's like, okay, but can we get back to the part where they kick butt?
Yeah, the movie, how, a similar type thing, he has his, top spy and his top general, and they happen to be, women that are part of this, like, warrior class, and it seems more like they're not just, arm candy sidekicks. They were, best at what they did. Yeah.
In here, and to kind of bounce off of what you said, in Black Panther, they feel like they're strong warrior women who just also happen to be, beautiful women. In here, it feels like we have very beautiful women who just happen to be warriors. Like that.
Exactly.
Yes.
Yeah.
Here's the thing. I like this book. as much as I'm harping on it, like, I enjoyed it. There's a lot of, like, the fight scenes and stuff were really cool. But it really does feel like this is the blueprint, like a very rough blueprint for the movie. And I think in a sense that makes me equally love it more and hate it more. Because there's stuff that's in here.
Because you've seen it done better.
Yes. I think if I had read this book maybe, I don't know, 2 years ago, I don't think I would have as many problems with it as I do now. But I can appreciate this
book. I don't think I would have followed it as well.
You don't think so?
You know, I felt like, you know, knowing what I know from the movie that informed a lot of the book, but I mean, it's not the same plot at all or anything. It's just, there's some of the same characters, you know, so I'm more aware of that world, and it wasn't just like, oh, there's Black Panther and this huge entourage of people that I don't know anything about except for there's some arm candy and that's a little scritchy, but
it's kind of like, it's kind of like that. It's kind of like that grandpa who just says stuff he shouldn't, but like, you still like him.
Oh.
You like him. He tries. He tries to get hashtag woke, but he's a product of his time.
I think about that redneck meme. Where, I forget the name of it, where it's, you know, says terrible things, but it's really well-meaning.
Like, oh, yeah.
Sometimes I feel like that's us, frankly.
Oh, I try not to be, I promise.
By the way, since we've been talking, I've also been flipping around online, just looking up different resources, things that Christopher Priest has said about this run, and what other people have said about this run. According to Comic Book Resources, Volume 3 of Black Panther, which is this series, Christopher Priest wrote all of the issues except for two of them.
Huh.
And what's really annoying about this is that Joe Quesada is the credited storyteller on 4 of the 5 issues we've read. So I don't actually know which 2 issues they are, or even if those 2 issues were in this section that we read. Mm-hmm. So that's a little frustrating to me. But other things that I'm reading about this run talk about sort of the craziness that happens later on. So this run is pretty storied. It's pretty highly regarded. My suspicion is that the best is yet to come.
Yeah.
Okay.
I like, and I'm in the same boat as you guys. I actually do like this book. There's a part of me that thinks I liked it maybe even a little better than you, John. Because you said you liked it, and I liked it too. And I don't know. I think you guys maybe picked up on more problems than I did in it. I don't even know what I'm talking about. I liked the book.
Okay.
I'm excited to read more into it later to see some of the other things that he gets into. Because, I mean, this story starts with Black Panther getting in a fist fight with Satan. I mean, that's pretty decent comic book shenanigans right there. I'm okay with that.
Oh, heck yeah. Played,
the thing I love, though, is, like, this whole, like, Satan situation. Or not... this whole Satan situation. This whole Satan situation is played off in 2 ways. It's played off as a very comic relief thing with Ross. Anytime it's him and the devil, it's a comedy thing. It's almost like a Seinfeld episode titled "That One with the Devil" or something. But Ross when Black, pants.
I mean, enough said. It's comedy.
Yeah. But as soon as, you know, Black Panther comes in, it totally flips it. It becomes a very serious thing, and it's not until like those two kind of worlds have to, well, not two worlds, but like it's not until Zuri is involved where it gets comical again.
Yeah, yeah.
And that Mephisto stuff is, I think, the best stuff in these 5 issues.
I think it's because that's where we get the most Black Panther there.
Yeah,
you know, it feels more like it's happening in real time.
Yeah. I don't know. I think I still have to say, though, for my money, I think I still prefer more modern Black Panther, just based on what we've read on this podcast, which isn't a whole lot granted, but this feels not entirely similar to the Black Panther from Secret Wars.
Yeah, I think in recent years, they've definitely put more emphasis on Black Panther as a scientist. And that goes back to kind of what I was saying earlier. This is Black Panther the superhero, which we haven't seen a whole lot of.
Yeah.
Right. Actually, I think I'm going to go out on a limb here and say that of all of the characters that we've read thus far, T'Challa is the one that we're the least familiar with.
Oh, yeah.
You're probably right. I'm looking at our list.
Like, the only other character is maybe Frankenstein's monster from that one book, but let's be real.
Or Squirrel Girl, but there's not a whole lot to get there. And what we read is a pretty good, you know...
I've read more of Squirrel Girl. I definitely know more about Squirrel Girl than what we've covered in the podcast. But I mean, like, collectively, as a group, I think for all three of us, Black Panther's a bit of a blind spot.
Yeah.
And I think out of all the characters, the one we definitely know the most of is Satan.
True.
Yeah. Yeah. This is not the first time we've run into Mephisto on this podcast.
Nor will it be the last, I'm sure.
Yeah.
Any final thoughts on Black Panther?
I want to read more, and so it could have been worse.
Could have been worse is not exactly a rousing endorsement.
No, I did like it. You know what? I did like it.
You know what, though? I feel the same way. It's I love this, but it could have been worse.
All right. On that note, why don't we move on to Captain Marvel?
Yay!
So, Captain Marvel, the 2012 series... I remember when this book came out, this was kind of a big deal. It was all over the comics news sites. So this is, I believe, Captain Marvel Volume 7, written by Kelly Sue DeConnick, with art by Dexter Soy, and for the last part, Emma Rios. This is a story of Carol Danvers, who has... been an Avenger for quite some time. She just picked up this new costume. Captain America persuades her to finally take the name Captain Marvel, which had been used in the past by Mar-Vell, a Kree soldier who fought for the humans on Earth and eventually died of cancer. So Carol Danvers takes the name Captain Marvel, and her very first adventure as Captain Marvel is a time travel story. One of her idols, this woman named Helen Cobb, who was part of the Mercury 13 program, which was designed to help train women to become astronauts, Helen Cobb leaves her an airplane. She decides that she's going to try to use this airplane to beat Helen Cobb's aviation records. Little does she know that in this airplane there is a fragment of a device that is actually involved in making Carol Danvers, Captain Marvel, and this device, like, activates, and it sends Carol back in time. She winds up in a scuffle on the, like, against some Japanese soldiers during World War II, and she fights alongside these other female soldiers, who are also not supposed to be there. They've also been displaced in time. Carol time hops again, winds up actually meeting Helen Cobb, finds out that Helen actually gave her the plane and set this device in the plane as a way of potentially tricking Captain Marvel into undoing her origin, which we actually get a recap of the origin. Yon-Rogg, this Kree militant terrorist, uses Carol Danvers to try to trap Captain Marvel, the original Mar-Vell. Mar-Vell comes up in, he saves Carol, and the explosion of this giant device transfers some of Captain Marvel's powers to Carol Danvers. All that out of the way, Helen Cobb is trying to trick Carol Danvers into stopping the explosion, preventing herself from getting her powers, and as a result, Helen Cobb would get those powers and become Captain Marvel herself. So, this is an interesting story. It takes a lot of twists, a lot of turns, and... it's a time travel story, which makes it even more confusing. At the end of the day, though, this is really meant to be an introduction to Carol Danvers as Captain Marvel. We get the slick new costume. We see her putting on the Kree helmet every now and again. We get that crazy haircut, that mullet sort of thing that I absolutely love. And we get to see a lot of Carol's bold, courageous, brash bit... what's the word I'm looking for? She's a bit impulsive. She's a bit stubborn.
She's a little bit country and a little bit rock and roll.
There you go.
She actually probably is a little bit of both. frankly, I think it's great. There's definitely stuff to talk about here. I've read the story a couple of times. I used to have the trade. I've collected a fair bit of Captain Marvel over the years. So I kind of already know where I land on this. What did you guys think of it?
I really enjoyed it. Yeah, it was great.
I think one of the things I enjoy about modern or like new Captain Marvel, and I like to think it's I like to think that she had an influence on the industry in giving us strong women who are also insecure.
Mm-hmm.
Because we used to have, I mean, we still do. We still have, you know, we're getting a bigger variety of female characters. But it felt for the longest time that female characters were allowed to be one or the other and not both. You could be a strong female character and not be insecure. Or that was your whole shtick, was that you were kind of insecure and unsure of your place in the comics universe, right? And I like having a character who is both. And I think that's really kind of permeated towards other characters, like kind of like Jessica Jones and Jessica Drew, and even Gwen Stacy in the new like Spider-Verse stuff. And it's really nice having kind of a bigger range of character, of, you know, being able to, you know, kick ass, but still wonder, should you take names?
So, John, what are you thinking?
I really enjoyed it. I did not enjoy the art at first, but once she gets up and she kind of clears her head, what does she say, a minute, 58 seconds from, you know, Manhattan until she can clear the atmosphere, you know? She gets up there and has a moment. Like, there are some awesome shots in that first issue of just, you know, Carol by herself in her Captain Marvel suit in front of the planet, you know. And then I liked all the art in World War II, or the time-displaced fighting they did, whatever, where they're, all the Kree ships and everything were super cool. And the art style changes once she's with Cobb in, you know, the still past, but slightly closer to the future. Was it like 61, I think? I think the art worked at that point, but that was a big shift, yeah. Yeah. But some really, really great stuff in that World War II section there. So
yeah.
Both writing and art. The writing is consistently good throughout, but the art kind of jumps all over the place.
Yeah, fun fact, Kelly Sue DeConnick is great. She is really good writer. She's really, really good.
Also, grass grows, birds fly. What else?
So I have to say, I'm a little sad because I never picked this book up when it first came out. I was interested. Mm-hmm. And the thing that kept me off from picking this book up is the cover art. I don't like Ed McGuinness.
One of these days, when we actually read a full Ed McGuinness book, we're going to have it out, because I quite like him.
He's kind of one of my least favorite comic book artists.
Oh, man, I love Ed McGuinness.
I used to when I was 13.
I am still 13 at heart.
So I never picked it up, and then, like, reading it this time, and seeing the Dexter Soy art, I'm just like, what have I been missing? I love Dexter Soy.
Oh, I don't actually know much about Dexter Soy. He's did these books, but that's all I know.
So I used to follow him on DeviantArt, which is funny because one of the letters also says that in the letters page. and I thought that was hilarious. But I used to follow him on DeviantArt, and he's done, you know, work on a couple comics. So I love it. So I loved the fact that, like, for the first four and a half issues, it was beautiful Dexter Soy art, and then it kind of switched over to an art that's less of my liking, or at least in contrast to Dexter Soy. It goes from, like, this really stylized, shady style to a little bit more, and I'm going to quote past Steven here, to a more house style.
And you see,
I don't even know if it's house style in the later issues. I don't
think it is. No, it's not. It's a little bit more sketchy, but I think by contrast,
it looks like fill-in issue, Hawkeye fill-in issues is what I think.
I still like that art, but the contrast between the super bold lights and darks that you see in Dexter Soy's art to, like, kind of the sketchier, not as derogatory, but, like, webcomic-ish look to it.
Yeah. It's definitely, like, these characters... Shift. Yeah, these characters are a little more, like, loose. They're a little more, the figures, they play a little bit more fast and loose with the anatomy. Not necessarily because they don't know what they're doing, but more because they're interested in this fluidity, as opposed to Dexter Soy, who I think is a little bit more painterly, like, in his technique. And he does seem to be pretty interested in, at the very least, adhering to, like, I don't know. I think he's closer to Alex Ross than someone who's a little bit more, I guess, impressionistic. But I love the Emma Rios art, I gotta say. I like them both.
Yeah, I, I'm, I'm not saying I don't like it. It's just it was such a big shift. I think I would enjoy reading a whole Emma Rios book if I could get her art from beginning to end.
Which Rios has collaborated with Kelly Sue DeConnick on a couple of projects, so that's doable.
I mean, we should do that because I like the art, but like.
Yeah.
I keep saying it, and that might as well be the name of the episode. But that dang shift. That's my problem with comics, with like the serialized comic stuff, is more often than not, they try to get similar artists for a writer, right? But sometimes you get like these big shifts, and it just kind of takes you out of it.
Well, at least this happened during a shift in time in the story. There's a bit of like, you know, we get some help with the transition there.
Yeah, well, kind of, because you get that transition when she goes to the 60s for like the last couple of pages of like, I think it's issue 4.
Mm-hmm.
But then you switch over to issue 5 and it's a different art style.
Well, I agree with you about the covers, although I do not like the covers for 1 through 4, but then we get 2 Dodson covers and it's great.
Yeah. Oh, so actually, maybe you guys can clear this over me. Is the plane that she flies in Avenging Spider-Man the plane from here?
I don't know. I kind of think it is.
I think it's supposed to be, right?
Like, yeah, that would make sense.
Okay.
I don't, but I'd never actually put that together. It would make sense to me.
Huh. Okay.
Because it's all the same rough time, right?
Not to keep harping on the art, or like not to keep reiterating the stuff, like the conversation with the art over and over again. But there's just one of the things that I like about this book is just how many great images there are in it. We've already kind of mentioned issue 1, page 15, when she takes her mask off and says, "I'm taking the damn name." It's a great shot of her.
Yeah.
We get this great image in, I want to say, I'm guessing, so I'm going to have to flip to it real fast. I think it's in issue 2, when she hops back in time and comes face to face with one of these prowlers, these Kree ships, and the ship rises up behind her, and so she's backlit, so her face is in shadow, but she's got the superhero pose, wide stance, like shoulders squared, and then you flip the page over and she's turning around to face the ship and she says, "Do not run away from this fight."
Yeah.
I love that. I think that's like the Carol Danvers like mission statement is she does not run from a fight because she has the power to win the fight, and so she's gonna do it.
You know, actually talking about Carol Danvers moments, I think my favorite moment in this whole 6-issue run that we read is when they send the soldier back and she's like, bring, and she's like, tell your commanders, tell everybody, bring your ships. You know, we're here. And I want you to do this because I want you to know that it could not have gone any other way. And you're just like, girl, can you chill?
Seriously.
That is,
it is pretty great, though.
That is some intensity. Like, I don't know that there's any other character who's been nearly that intense that we've read.
Which is the best part about this, is that we have a superhero that, like, Carol Danvers has the Superman power set, basically.
Yeah.
She can fly, she's super strong, she's bulletproof, she can shoot laser beams. She's basically Superman. She does not act like Superman.
No.
Nope.
She is a military person, and I love the banter between her and Captain America at the beginning of the story, where, you know, she brags about technically outranking Captain America.
Yeah.
But, you know, Captain America went through the military, and he developed, well, he always had this strong sense of moral clarity, this strong sense of duty. And Carol Danvers has a very similar sense of duty. But to see those two play off each other, they could not be more different within this one little sphere.
I would like a Captain Marvel, Captain America, like miniseries,
like a team up book.
Yeah,
yeah.
The Captains.
It would just be them. Like they would just be ping ponging bad guys between them, just punching them and just taking them out.
I mean, that's what they do to the Absorbing Man.
Yeah, I really thought he got
powers.
I thought he got a fist on the shield and was going to turn into vibranium. In the comics, is it adamantium or is it also vibranium in the shield?
It's a hybrid, if I remember correctly. Mm-hmm. It's a mix of both, and that makes it difficult to duplicate.
Right.
Yeah. Wow. So, we read this book because the movie is coming out this weekend.
You guys are going, yes?
I don't have a firm plan to see it yet because, you know, the wedding is in 3 weeks, but I'm planning on seeing it. The thing is, like, I don't know if you guys have been tapped in much to the online conversation surrounding Captain Marvel.
No, I just know that there's trolls being trolls, and it makes me angry.
It makes me extremely angry.
Yeah.
Because a lot of people are trying to review bomb Captain Marvel. They're trying to spread a bunch of disinformation about Brie Larson. Brie Larson said something about how the press pool tends to be predominantly white men, and so she wanted to give other voices a chance, and people are interpreting that as some sort of anti-white male screed, which is frankly insulting to white men to say that. It's like, we're not that sensitive. Come on, guys. Stop being such snowflakes.
Yeah, if history is any indication of what white men are, we are insensitive.
But what was interesting to me about this is a lot of people who are voicing these opinions are using past behavior of Carol Danvers from the comics as justification for hating on the character. Specifically, the way Carol behaved during the Civil War series is she was on the registration side during the first Civil War, and I think she beat up Jessica Jones, like, in front of her child or something like that. She like attacked one of her friends and put her in the hospital very mercilessly in front of her child, and it's kind of horrifying. And then in Civil War II, she basically gets a bunch of people killed because she's on what is the equivalent of the pro-registration side in that story.
Yeah.
And I'm sitting here remembering 2008 and how there was a movie based on Iron Man when Iron Man had just come off of Civil War and was at, like, an all-time popularity low, at least as far as, like, his behavior in the comics. People did not approve of what he was doing. And I can't help but see those parallels.
It's almost like people or characters, you know, can make mistakes.
Yeah.
And errors. And right. Maybe that's kind of the point of watching characters in a serialized story format, to see them grow and learn.
True.
Weird.
It's almost like one is getting more scrutiny than the other.
Oh, there's also that. But then, you know, at the end of the day, we're also dealing with a fictional character. And I've always looked at superhero comics as something akin to, not necessarily mythology, but like folklore.
Yes.
Y'all ever heard of Robin Hood?
Mm-hmm.
Seems to ring a bell.
You know how the Robin Hood story ends?
The real story? Marion
kills him.
Oh, you know, I did not know that.
Nobody ever makes that part into the movie.
Huh.
I thought it was some other woman, but it is Maid Marian?
At least in one version. But again, we're dealing with folklore. So there are multiple versions of the story.
Sure.
You kind of can just pick and choose the ones that you like the best. Like, we all kind of just ignore that time that Iron Man got turned into a teenage boy. We all kind of just ignore that time that Nightcrawler became the Pope.
Are you serious?
Oh, we're going to read that one eventually, don't worry.
We all ignore the time that Black Goliath was shot through the chest with a lightning bolt and buried in chains and a flag.
By Cyborg Thor. Oh.
Just thought I'd
Robo Supermensch. It's just filthy.
Yeah.
We all ignore that time that Aunt May was actually Peter's mom.
Oh, Marvel really tries to ignore that one.
Right! Ugh. And so, this is the thing that really bugs me. Yeah, okay, Captain Marvel, Carol Danvers, has some shady parts in her character's backstory. She also has some excellent parts in her backstory. She also has this book, and this book is the foundation for the movie, and this book is good. So what are you whining about?
You know what I hate and I love about this book? Well, I don't hate about this book. I hate about the conversation. This is a conversation I had with somebody, and we were discussing, you know, this stuff with Captain Marvel, and he said, you know, maybe characters, or, you know, or maybe these, you know, as he kind of said, you know, maybe these people should stop appropriating the name. And I said, hold on, Captain Marvel? He's like, yeah. I'm like, there's been like three Captain Marvels. She's like the latest one to take the title. He's like, that's exactly what I'm saying. I'm like, but it's a title. It's a mantle. It gets passed down. Like, she's not stealing the name. Like, it's something that gets passed down. And I love the fact that this book kind of tackles that. And it's kind of one of those things where it's like, you don't read the comics. You don't understand, like, what's going on. Like, no, and I brought this up, and it's like, nobody complained when Bucky took over as Captain America. Nobody complained when, I mean, I'm pretty sure somebody did. Nobody complained when Dick Grayson took over as Batman.
Like, oh, people absolutely complained about
yeah,
that.
Yeah, they were, yeah.
But no.
But not in the stands. Same way, yeah.
Yeah, but it's kind of like, that's kind of the point of these titles. And that's, and you know, kind of to another extent, that's kind of the whole point to Academy Award winning Best Animated Film Picture Spider-Verse.
Seriously.
That anybody can be these characters because it's a title and it's about what that mm-hmm. title means. Captain America isn't defined exclusively by super steroid World War II veteran Steve Rogers. He's defined more than anything by what Captain America is supposed to represent, which is supposed to be the best part of the United States and, you know, the best ideals. And I think Captain Marvel has not only taken a mantle that frankly was coming out of was becoming irrelevant, and it's making that name a relevant thing.
Yeah, I think it's important, if you have the conversation about the title of Captain Marvel, to remember why this title exists. And the title exists to screw Billy Batson. Like, 100%. The only reason Captain Marvel as a character exists is because DC Comics had a character named Captain Marvel who, side note, rules. But Marvel didn't want them publishing a magazine called Captain Marvel, so they created Mar-Vell, and nobody cared. Mar-Vell died of cancer. Like, when Superman died, he got punched to death by a monster in hot pants. And when Batman died, he had a luchador snap him in half over his knee. Like, you had crazy, like, over-the-top comic book things.
Batman just broke his back. Let's, you know, this is a comic book podcast.
Okay, fine. When Batman died, he got shot in the face with time beams.
Hey, Superman also died from cancer.
Yeah.
Oh, okay, yeah, in the greatest comic book story ever. So, point taken. But, like, so, truthfully, not that many people cared about Mar-Vell, who might actually be the new heir to character who stays dead.
Has he really not been brought back?
So, Mar-Vell died in sometime before Infinity Gauntlet, so I'm thinking late 80s, and he came back during Secret Invasion, but it wasn't actually him, it was a Skrull. But after Mar-Vell died, Monica Rambeau became Captain Marvel for a while, and she's apparently going to be in the movie. Then after Monica Rambeau, there was Janice Vell, then there was Phyla Vell, then there was the Skrull, then there was a Novar. Carol Danvers is like the sixth or seventh person to be Captain Marvel.
Oh, she's the seventh, yeah, you were right.
Yeah. Wow. So, if you're going to have that conversation, it's like, they need to just retire the name. Nobody cared about the name until Carol Danvers had it.
Yeah.
And now it means something. So, I'm 100% on your side in this conversation, yeah. Aldo. I think it's ridiculous.
And I kind of hate it, because I hate when people say, maybe they should just make new characters. And it's like, you know, I agree, but no offense, because I love the character, but look at Static Shock. Like, he was a new character created for that specific demographic. He's a character of that demographic. And as much as I love the show, where are his comics? Where is his movie? Yeah, it's unfortunate, because I would love for them to, you know, to flourish, but they don't. And maybe that's a fault of the people. Maybe that's a fault of the creators. I don't know.
I would say that it's probably, in general, the fault of the brand.
Yeah.
like, they have these brands built up around these characters, and it's very hard to associate a new character with that brand.
Yeah. So I say, you know, more power to these characters appropriating the name. Like, more power to Miles Morales becoming Spider-Man, to Kamala Khan becoming the new Ms. Marvel, to Carol Danvers becoming the new Captain Marvel. Like, yeah. Kudos.
I don't even think appropriating is the right word.
I am using it to spite.
Like, because what it is, it really is a passing of the torch. It's like, okay, we've had the generation that was run by white men. We're trying to build a future that includes other voices. And so now these characters are inheriting these titles. And I think that's something that's really kind of significant. Carol Danvers is, I think, one of the only characters, legacy characters like this, who just straight up says, you know what, screw it, I'm going to be Captain Marvel now. Along with the rest of them, there was a passing of the torch.
Yeah.
Like, in a very real way, there was a concerted effort for the forebear to hand that title off to someone else.
Yeah.
And so, frankly, I think the fact that Captain Marvel, I think the fact that she steps up and takes this name, when she's fully right to have it, like, she's military, she's Air Force, she has Marvel powers, there's no reason she shouldn't be able to take it. I think that's pretty great, and actually strikes a nice contrast to some of these other things.
Mm-hmm.
I think if there was a message I could give to just, like, the whole world at once, it's like, we tried rich old angry white guys being in charge for a long, long time now. And a lot of people died.
Extremist armor.
Yeah.
Any final thoughts on Captain Marvel?
I'm so excited for the movie now, and I'm so excited that I have all these comics to read. Kelly Sue DeConnick is great.
You know, I'm actually really happy we read this Kelly Sue DeConnick book. I know we've read another one that was the
Why Stands for Freedom.
Why Stands for Freedom. But it was really kind of nice being able to see her flex her writing muscles. They're good muscles.
Good writing. Good writing in this.
Keep on flexing.
She is a solid creator. Like, definitely one of the best writers Marvel had at this time. One of the better writers of the 21st century thus far. She's usually, she's currently a featured creator on Marvel's, on the Marvel Unlimited app. You click the creators button and bam, there she is. Top page, her picture right there. Yeah, good stuff. I think it's time to rank these books.
It's going to be tricky.
Yeah, I think it'll be interesting to see where these go. So, looking at our list right now, we have currently ranked at number one, Ms. Marvel by G. Willow Wilson and Adrian Alfona. Number 47, the bottom of our list, is One More Day by J. Michael Straczynski and Joe Quesada. So,
stay there forever.
Where do we want to rank The Client?
Boy, is that a loaded question.
Yeah, this is a hard one.
It's tough because we can't rank the parts that we liked high and the stuff that fell off low, you know?
Right.
We have to, it's a whole work altogether. We're all sharing this Google Doc, whoever highlighted the spot 26 right there, that's where I was, like, looking to start, like, is it better or worse than, so.
That was me, and I'm thinking where I like it in relation to this.
Mm-hmm.
I would want to put it below Why Stands for Freedom and above Reroute Williams.
I don't think that's a bad place for it, actually. I'm kind of struggling with this as well, because, you know, The Client, it has so many things that I like, and it, I think, is a pretty good introduction to the Black Panther stuff that's going to come. But actually, the Riri Williams story is a pretty good comparison, I think, because it's, again, like, we can see a lot of potential that isn't quite fully realized here.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
But we know that this Black Panther story was more influential, or was very influential, and we don't yet know how influential Riri Williams is going to be in the long run. So I think just based on that alone, it does have to go above that.
John, how do you feel about that?
Mostly I'm trying to come up with an argument of why it should be lower than Doctor Strange there, but I can't. I just,
Yeah, I think the only thing that, and I'm going to do this for you, John, I think the only thing that The Search for Eternity.
Oh, you said it right. It makes me so happy.
I think the only thing that story really has over the client, the Black Panther story,
is the art.
Is the art, which is really, really good in The Search for Eternity.
Oh, you know what? You are right.
What?
Yeah.
You know, thinking about the dialogue in both of those, and I'm not going to say this very often, I think I would rather read The Search for Eternity.
What?
They're both
Stan Lee dialogue?
What? They're both kind of verbose, but I think Stan Lee's dialogue will never rub me wrong, kind of like this dialogue did.
See, that's why, and I would put it above Mary Jane Homecoming because we don't need to get into it again.
No, I'm not going to fight you on that. This definitely goes above Homecoming.
Yeah, like
as much as I like Homecoming, this goes above it.
Yeah, because if you remember, I came out swinging against the dialogue in
Black Panther. I remember.
Yeah, it sounds about right, yeah.
Yeah, I was not fond of it, to say the least.
I think the things skipped were, and most of it were yelled at some, yeah.
I think I'm outvoted here, actually, because I do think it goes higher. But not much higher, so I'm not going to lose too much of a stink.
I think John and I are probably on the same page about this one.
Yeah.
Gonna get below.
You're supposed to side with me against John, Aldo.
Listen, you're the one that made a compelling argument for John.
Yeah.
Literally all I said is the artwork is better in The Search for Eternity.
Uh-huh.
That is literally the only thing I said.
That was a good argument.
What do you have against Steve Ditko getting love?
Literally nothing. I think he's great. Honestly, that's one thing that I can say thanks to this podcast for.
Mm-hmm.
Because I've never been a big fan of Steve Ditko. I appreciate him now in a way that I hadn't ever before. So, yeah, this podcast is expanding horizons.
So now where do we put Captain Marvel?
Yeah, the Captain Marvel that's story trickier. In Pursuit of Flight goes significantly higher.
Yeah.
I don't think it's quite top 10. I love this story. I think it's excellent. I don't see this going higher than Marvel's.
I'd put it, my vote is 14, replacing The Neverending Struggle, the Deadpool book we read.
Yeah.
That's my thing.
I almost want to put this below Coming of Galactus, like right above Last Days of Magic. But I have a hard time because The Last Days of Magic has really good, consistent art.
Yes, I was just going to say those exact words. Aldo, dance, my puppet. Steven will listen to you, Aldo. Say the things I wish to say. There's a great side note. This has nothing to do with anything, but I have to say it because it just popped into my head. There's a great bit by a comedian's name I can't remember right now, but he said, next time you go to church, say the Lord's Prayer like a hobbit. It's hilarious. Be like, "Ah, Father who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done on earth as it is in heaven. Lead us not into temptation. No. But deliver us from evil."
It's like, it'll be the most fun that you have on a Sunday. Anyway.
That just popped into my head. That has nothing to do with anything. I told you before going in. That's what happened.
He did say that.
So here's my struggle with putting Captain Marvel that high.
Is it your never-ending struggle?
Well,
that's a bad taste. I'm sorry.
Yeah. Where I'm struggling is, I'm not sure it goes above Runaways. But if it does go above Runaways, I think it goes just above. I actually think it's kind of comparable to Runaways in the sense that they're both, like, surprisingly influential. They're both kind of setting the tone for the direction that Marvel Comics would go in. Runaways was, if anything, I think a bit ahead of its time. Whereas Carol Danvers was definitely, like, this Captain Marvel story is definitely something that's more...
been a long time coming.
Yeah, like, it's overdue, if anything.
Yeah.
So the reason I would put it above Runaways, and this goes back to something we said, is that, like, nobody cared about the previous six incarnations of Captain Marvel until mm-hmm. Carol Danvers became Captain Marvel. And I think that speaks mm-hmm. volumes.
And I agree, but I also want to raise the question, without Runaways, would we have Captain Marvel? Because I think Runaways, one of its main achievements is that it was a story that was actually pretty popular among girl readers.
So mostly girl team.
Yep, mostly girl team. Really great, compelling girl characters that were, felt like they were written like characters and not just like props, which did happen a fair bit, frankly, in comics in the late 90s, early 2000s. And so, like, I kind of wonder if that doesn't prime the pump for Captain Marvel. Now, I don't necessarily have the information to back that up, but I do kind of wonder if the impact of Runaways long-term isn't a little bit higher than the Carol Danvers one, even though Carol Danvers has the movie and Runaways just has that TV show.
I was going to say, wait until, I mean, we don't know what's going to happen this weekend, because, like, we might say, I don't know about this, and then it makes, like, Black Panther money, and it's like, holy cow.
Yeah, true.
So I don't think the comparison, I okay, so it's not that the comparison isn't valid.
I'd be interested to see if it was, but I don't know that it, yeah.
Yeah, it's speculation on my part.
I don't think Runaways has as big an impact as this argument makes it seem it does. I think I would bet money that, you know, 20 years from now, we will still be referring to this Captain Marvel run as like a really influential set of books. And unfortunately, I don't think Runaways will be in that same conversation.
I actually 100% disagree with you. I do think people will be talking about Runaways in 20 years. Just because, again, I've listened to a lot of comics press, comics podcasts that talk about Runaways, and it has had its influence. Now, I'm not sure it's going to age entirely well, because we already talked about how dated it is when we read it.
Yeah, that's
just only it feels like very dated.
15 but, years.
Yeah.
But I do think a lot of comic book creators came up reading Runaways. I know a lot of comic book fans give Runaways to their friends as, hey, this is the book that'll get you into comics. And so I question whether Runaways isn't going to have the bigger influence in the long run. But if it goes above Runaways, I don't want to put it above The Last Days of Magic, because The Last Days of Magic is basically what if Doctor Strange was actually Hellboy, and I'm, you know, here for that.
Yeah. The only reason we're not reading Hellboy on this podcast is because it's not owned. All right, well, I think I'm the one that's being outvoted here, unfortunately.
Just barely. Just barely. Like, I could really go either way, but I do think we're kind of underestimating Runaways a little bit.
I think continue. Potentially... like, Captain Marvel is a character I think that belongs in top 10. If we were doing top 10 characters or whatever, Captain Marvel might be closer to the top than the Runaways. Especially, I think the cultural impact is going to be real big. So
yeah. Oh, and it has been. Just, like, Google the Carol Corps, and you'll see that the cultural impact of Captain Marvel is already pretty big. But I'm going to say this one last thing about Captain Marvel, having read a lot of the Kelly Sue DeConnick stuff. This is not the best story. I think there's a better one coming up.
Cool.
So, yeah, okay, that was an interesting discussion.
Yeah, that was better than I expected.
Yeah, I thought we were going to have more solidarity on that.
Well, I thought there was going to be more fighting, so this is good.
Oh, well, pleasant surprise for you.
We actually agreed with John this podcast. How weird.
It's, you know what it is? It comes down to the fact that Hawkeye isn't number one. Everything else is just moot.
We've already lost the war,
so who cares about the other battles?
Hey man, it makes feel better. Spider-Man's almost in the 20s.
Yeah, but Spider-Man's also number 2, number 6. Okay, so that wraps up our discussion, our ranking of Captain Marvel and the Black Panther. Pretty great stories, pretty fun discussion. Next time, we're only going to read one story. It's a little bit of a longer one. This is another listener suggestion. This has come from Joseph. I think it's only appropriate that we do just the one story because our next episode, we are ranking our 50th comic. So well, our comic 50th story. Comic, our 50th comic story that we are going to rank is Maximum Carnage.
Dun, dun, dun.
Which is kind of a mess. Like I've read it before. It's been at least a decade, probably longer.
So, I've played the Super Nintendo game.
Oh, yeah, it did have a video game, didn't it?
Did.
Man.
How about that?
Yeah.
That's... Catch me outside. Sorry.
I'm going to go into it not thinking of it as homework, but thinking that it will be as cool as my, like, 7-year-old, 8-year-old self thought it would be. if it's the story that I'm thinking of, because I do remember like an older cousin having a comic that was, you know, Venom and Spider-Man team up to fight Carnage, and it was like, oh my gosh, they're all in the same issue. It's going to be amazing. So I'm just going to go with that mindset and try not to be too sad when it crashes and burns.
We'll see how it goes. So Maximum Carnage ran through a bunch of Spider-Man books. In 1993, there was Spider-Man Unlimited, Web of Spider-Man, The Amazing Spider-Man, Adjectiveless, just regular Spider-Man.
Oh, Peter Parker.
And then Peter Parker, Spectacular the Spectacular Spider-Man.
Spectacular.
And it runs through all of these. So, Maximum Carnage is a 14-part story that runs through five different Spider-Man books. The reading order, I think the easiest place to find that is just going to be on the marvel.fandom.com, the Marvel Fandom Wiki. I think it's the same reading order that they've got on Wikipedia. Going through Marvel Unlimited, you should be able to find the reading order in their events tabs.
But it might not actually be in order through their automated system.
Yeah, they do tend to order things a little bit funny. If I remember correctly, they've actually had problems with the order that stories have been printed in trades for some of these big events.
Here's what's interesting, too. The issues that are marked 10, 11, and 12 on the reading lists that we're referring to were published after the last one. So Spider-Man Unlimited number 2, which is the last one in this reading list, came out on August 1st, 93. Web of Spider-Man 103, Amazing Spider-Man 380, and Spider-Man 37 looks like they were August 10th of 93.
Well, it wouldn't be the first time that the publishing order kind of got the story messed up a little bit. I mean, we saw that with Captain Marvel.
We saw that I mean, we didn't see that here, but I experienced that with Secret
you experienced
Wars.
It with Secret Wars, yeah.
Yeah.
These are labeled, it looks like they are labeled like part 1, part 2, part 3, part 14, all the way up, so I think we're okay. I think for once we can trust what's on the app to be correct.
At the very least, we can trust what's on the cover.
Fatal Attractions is why I have trust issues. I read that. I read that thing out of order, and boy, did that not help anything.
All right. Well, we've been recording for nigh on 2 hours at this point.
Boy.
Anybody have any back matter that they want to bring up? I actually think we can skip it today. I don't think we have much to talk about.
I'm excited for Captain Marvel.
I think that's really where it is. We're excited for Captain Marvel.
Oh, I was going to say, I'm going to be out of town that weekend, but I'm going to drag my buddies to go see it. I don't care that we're on vacation. It's part of it.
If it's a big movie like this, that's the exception. Because, you know, I think vacation, you can't do something that you can do at home. But you also don't want to miss the premiere.
Exactly. The Twitterverse is going to be lit.
No kidding. I've had
on
to like
fire,
stay
perhaps.
Off.
Yeah. It's fine. Everything's fine.
This is fine.
This is fine.
You're
this
the dog. Fine. You're the dog at his table on fire.
Yep. I'm happy you picked up on that.
Yeah, man.
All right. I think that's going to wrap us up for tonight. John, Aldo, thank you so much for this riveting discourse.
Oh, thank you.
Oh, thank you.
This has been the Superhuman Registration Podcast. Ladies and gentlemen, you are on our list, which means that you are on our block list for Twitter. Seriously, don't at me.
When you said block list for Twitter, I heard our blockbuster Twitter, and I was like,
that's what
those
I heard
two
too.
Things didn't exist in the same timeline.
Oh my gosh, you're right.
No, I had a late fee at a Blockbuster, and I was all nervous about it. And then, like, it closed. Like, it was one of the first Blockbusters to go under, and I was like, "Haha, take that!" So,
I want to point out that Blockbuster is actually still around. There is a Blockbuster.
I know it's in like Alaska somewhere. They tweet mean things.
There's one Bend, Oregon.
Oh, is that where it is?
I'm not gonna lie. That is a significant percentage of why I want to move there.